which are basically partnerships that bring together the different players that make an industry work. And we're particularly pleased that we have Pete Ingardio, who's come down from Business Week in New York. If you're interested in insightful commentary on the innovation scene, let me recommend Business Week to you. Thanks to Pete and some of his colleagues' efforts, there's some really interesting things being written there for the American business community, and not some of the knee-jerk thing that the government needs to go away, but actually how the government, industry, and universities have to work together. And also, what, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, what other countries are doing. So with no further ado, let me introduce Pete Ingardio, and he has a substantial panel to get through. And could I suggest, by the way, for the speakers, unless you specifically wish to sit, we'd be grateful if you would stand, because the mic is better.
Holding, Charles has been holding. It's been extremely educational for me in understanding the real competitive challenges facing the United States. Like, I've spent most of my career writing about the rise of Asia, rise of India, rise of China, rise of Taiwan, and give me a fantastic insight into the real debates here. In this economic environment, in particular, it's no longer sufficient just for the United States to be ahead in R&D. And new technology, especially in areas like photovoltaics, where the capital markets now are pretty much, I think, will not fund new entrants that don't have proven ability to manufacture and to scale up. And this panel is going to get in a lot about this issue, about the challenge, and how do you overcome the challenge of getting from the lab into being able to manufacture. We have several panelists here who are working on this in the photovoltaic and renewable energy fields. And we also have some very good participants with it that have years of experience of this in the semiconductor industry and how some of those practices and methods may be applicable to photovoltaics. We're going to start out. Okay, we're going to try. Let's see. Okay, we're going to start out with Steve and Pedicles.
That's pretty good.
Okay, from SVTC. Steve.
Is that this? Thanks, Pete. So, I'm going to be talking about what we see as one of the key needs in the photovoltaic industry and our particular solution to it, and that is the need to help companies transition, as Pete said, technologies from lab-scale prototype through to fully qualified manufacturing process, something that can be funded by the capital markets or by programs like the DOE Loan Guarantee Program. We've heard lots of different versions of the Valley of Death today and what that means. One version that I tend to look at is the Valley of Death associated with funding for capital equipment intensive industries like the photovoltaic industry. So if you look at the standard funding profile for PV companies, it generally looks something like this, and obviously there are exceptions, but companies will go and they'll raise $10 or $20 or $30 million to do their R&D. They'll get their proof of concept, go back to the capital markets, raise $50 to $70 million, build a pilot plant and develop their manufacturing process and their product, and then go back again for $200 or $300 million to build their first manufacturing line. And in the past, there have been a number of companies that have followed this trajectory. Of course, with the downturn in the capital markets, funding has really disappeared for this segment. It's actually disappeared for all segments, but there are a lot of companies in this phase already that have a significant amount of capital, have great technology, but not enough to make it into and build a complete pilot line. And then there are programs like the Loan Guarantee Program, which can fund project finance, but which requires a completely de-risked technology before you actually qualify. And so how do you get from here to here? obviously this is where as a country we want to be, because this is where the clean energy and all these new green jobs are going to come from. And we've heard about the impact on jobs from increasing megawatt capacity several times today. Our proposal is that you can bridge this valley of death through a solar development center, product development center, a center with the manufacturing tools, infrastructure, and engineering expertise needed to make this transition, where companies can go, be resident in the facility, and leverage those capabilities to very quickly move to a fully qualified manufacturing process. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. The goal here is that this center should be able to cut development costs by because companies don't have to fund all the capital equipment up front, and they don't have to pay for 100% of the equipment. They just pay for the fraction that they're going to use. Cut development times because they don't have to build out their own facility. They don't have to learn how to do things that the industry already knows how to do, but that their company has never done before, because they can leverage the expertise within the Solar Development Center. And the goal is to de-risk the technology so that it becomes financeable, whether it's through government or private finance. And overall, result in a much more accelerated production ramp, because the output of the Solar Development Center is something that is a qualified manufacturing process that just can just be replicated at scale. One thing to realize is that this is very different than a research center. We've got great research centers in the United States. We are the leaders in the world by any metric in photovoltaic R&D. That's not what our center is going to do. We are a product development center staffed with product development people for product development purposes, and very synergistic with labs like NREL and university labs, also the energy hubs and the various programs coming out of DOE. And I wasn't aware of it before today, so I stuck this in just in the last couple of minutes, but SISOC is also seems like a great synergistic relationship with what we provide. We take the output of those entities, research prototypes, and convert them to final products, and then eventually hand them off to the cell makers and module makers who do the manufacturing. That's another thing we're not good at, is large-scale volume manufacturing, but we do through pilot-scale production. Why do we think we can do this? I'm going to just give half a minute on this. SVTC, which is our company, has been doing this for about 8 years in the semiconductor space, providing the same service, transitioning lab-scale technologies to fully qualified manufacturable products, which normally get then shipped off to somewhere like TSMC for foundry manufacturing. Obviously, in the case of photovoltaics, there are a lot of reasons why that manufacturing should remain here in the United States, and it's one of the things I imagine everyone in this room is counting on. So we've been doing this for years in the CMOS space. We're just now getting started in the semiconductor space. This is not just a user facility like you find in university labs, and it's also not just a foundry. It's a mix of the two. User facilities, you go in, you use the tools, and hopefully you know how to do it correctly to get what you want. Foundries, you give them a recipe, and a few days later out comes your product, and you don't have any interaction with it. With SVTC, we allow customers to come into the fab, work hands-on with the tools, but with our operators, so they can leverage our expertise where it's valuable, they don't need to where it's not, and where they have key capabilities, they can get in there and get their hands dirty in the development process. So you keep that touch and feel part of development that you get by having your own fab, but without having to necessarily hire in an entire team of experts in areas that are outside of your company's core expertise. And this is just a representative of a bunch of companies that are currently in the SVTC CMOS fabs, showing the relative percentage of the engagement that are customer engineers versus SVTC engineers. Some cases, it's all one or the other. In a lot of cases, there's some gradient in between, and it changes over time. As your needs change, so can the staffing. So what are the key elements of a solar development center? This is what we think. There's obviously a lot of levels of detail you can include here, but in order to really be a product development and manufacturing center, it needs to have product development and manufacturing tools. There needs to be enough leverage across those tools that multiple companies can use them. It doesn't really buy you much if you have to have a custom tool set for every customer. It's just like building your own fab. But in addition to having leverage, you also need to still have the flexibility to innovate within that tool set. It needs to have a complete manufacturing culture. Again, it's not a research center. I think everybody here realizes that advanced materials are a big part of what's happening in photovoltaics. That needs to be included in the model. Analytical services and certification is important in terms of getting rapid feedback. And then one thing that we haven't talked about very much today, but we found in all of the with all the companies we've talked to, IP ownership and security is really critical. Unlike the semiconductor industry, where everybody shares baseline process IP and differentiates at the circuit, in PV, there is no circuit level. And so companies really are relying on their baseline process IP as their primary mode of defense from an IP standpoint. People need to have the comfort that if they have proprietary technology, they can bring it into the center, work with it, develop it, and own it when they leave. Sharing IP is not something that I've seen any PV company, small PV company, willing to consider. And then finally, this has to be a center that is going to service multiple types of customers. This isn't just about cell makers. It's about the entire industry, and I'll show you a little bit about how we see that. So in terms of the first three all kind of go together. It has to do with the tool set and the capabilities. You know, from a high level, we are establishing a baseline set of tools, the standard manufacturing process around which people will innovate. We will also have a number of specialized tools, things that aren't part of the baseline process but are standard to the industry, like contactless printing, as well as engineers and engineering services to basically do and develop the things people need, plus a standard process library so people don't have to reinvent processes that already exist, and all of that up through pilot scale. In addition to that, for the innovation part of this, we will accommodate proprietary tools. People who have developed their own tool, either for their own purposes or something that they want to sell to the industry, can bring those tools in, install them in secure bays so that they can work with them as part of the baseline process, but nobody else has access to them. And in some cases, they may choose to open those up to others once they're done so that they can show it off to the industry. Certainly working with novel process flows and novel materials are important. And then a variety of peripheral services like modeling and analytical services, failure analysis, reliability, and certification. So how does that all work? Well, I'll use our baseline process as an example. And just to be clear, because to me the world breaks down into wafer-based PV and thin film-based PV, our initial center is focused on wafer-based technologies. We do have plans for a thin film center, but what I'm going to be talking about today is our wafer-based center. If you look at this diagram, each of these squares represents a standard step in the wafer-based PV cell fabrication. And almost all wafer-based processes go through steps like this. There's always some sort of surface texturing and repair. You create the junction. There's a bunch of etch and isolation steps, anti-reflective steps, metallization to get the current out, and then isolation and test and sort. And within each of these, there is a tool. A couple of weeks ago, we announced a collaboration with Roth and Rao, who is going to install a 30-megawatt turnkey manufacturing line in our facility in San Jose. These are the tools that are part of that. The one difference between what we have and what you would buy if you bought a standard manufacturing line from Roth and Rao is that the robotics will be removed between each of the tools. So you can run the standard baseline process. You can get your 16% efficient cell or whatever it is they certify. Or at any point along that process, you can divert wafers to go do something else. And that's where innovation occurs. Whether that something else is a process or a new tool, that's up to the individual customers. But it means you don't have to build and maintain and run the tools that are the standard parts of your process. And for most wafer-based development, people are innovating in one or two process steps, and the rest are standard. So one question I get a lot is, well, you know, gee, is there really a lot of innovation going on in wafer-based technology? And I think most of the people here know there is. But I was surprised when I actually started pulling out where that innovation is and how prevalent it is. So if you look at the full process from wafers in to cells out, here are those baseline tools. Here are some of those alternative tools, printing and alternative etch. And then where are people innovating? Well, it starts at the wafer, people developing new types of feedstock, new types of surface texturing and repair, whether it's black silicon or nanostructured films or three-dimensional surfaces, new types of junction, multi-junction, implant, new types of surface coatings for anti-reflection, new types of metallization, whether it's architectures or processes. At every step, people are innovating. And each of those is one step that a customer would do all the standard steps, and then they're one proprietary step or two proprietary steps. And for most cases, that works. How do the facilities work? Well, we have the baseline tool set in one area of the fab. We have a set of bays that have some of these alternative tools available to customers. But the majority of the fab is allocated to these custom bays where customers can come and bring their own tools. They're secure. You can restrict access to your tools. Some people may choose to open them up later to allow people access to them. It depends on what their business model is. We also have our complete CMOS fabs. We have more than 100,000 square feet of Class 10 clean room. We've got 250 tools, 2,500 different processes. There's a lot of ways people are using CMOS technology and processes in photovoltaics. They have access to all of that through us. Manufacturing culture and expertise, that's really what we're all about. We're all staffed with manufacturing folks, and this is really synergistic with entities like NREL's PDIL, which is kind of on the research side of that division. Alternative materials, I won't spend any time on this, but we're very good, even in the CMOS space where materials compositions are challenging to bring into fabs. We currently run 52 different atomic materials through our CMOS fabs rather than the standard 12 that the industry uses, and we've never had a contamination problem between customers. Analytical services. Everything needs to be available. When you're developing new materials and new devices, you need to get feedback, and that includes reliability and certification. We wouldn't necessarily provide that directly, but we do plan on having in-house partners who will provide certification and reliability, either working with NREL or some of the other folks that you all know. So IP ownership. We think this is really critical. Obviously, I think we'll probably hear different opinions throughout the day. Our philosophy is your IP is your IP always, and that coming to work at SVTC should be the same as working in your fab from an IP standpoint. You should be able to bring IP, work with it safely, and leave with it when you're done. We don't put any hooks into it, and we have an extensive range of processes for preventing anybody else from getting access to it. I'm not going to go in any detail on what those processes are, but it goes from everything from contractual to teaching people how to protect their own IP. But probably the most important thing is we've been doing this now for about 8 years in the semiconductor space, and we've built a reputation for IP security. And that's something that you can tell people all day long, don't worry, your IP will be safe here. But until you can prove it, a lot of folks, especially in the somewhat paranoid field of photovoltaics, aren't going to believe that. And we actually now have about a half a dozen photovoltaic customers running through our CMOS fabs in advance of us having our PV lineup, which at least is an indication that we've passed that barrier in terms of being able to assure people of their IP security. And lastly, types of customers. This isn't just about cell makers. It's about the entire industry. Obviously, cell makers are one of the primary beneficiaries, but we've also talked about new feedstock makers. What about consumables makers? If you're going to develop a new ink, conductive ink, you need to qualify that and get all the statistics you need to sell that into the industry. Where can you do that? That's not always a trivial thing to do. Tool makers are another big part. A lot of companies developing new tools these days. developing new tools without access to the rest of the process is very difficult, but getting process feedback from somebody else's line that you don't have control over is also very difficult. So this is a facility where we see tool vendors coming in and developing and demonstrating their tools to the industry on this line. I was surprised there's actually a lot of panel makers that are interested in this, and I think Noel Brown is going to talk about some of the work they're doing in developing new panels, but access to modified cells in order to accommodate new panel architectures and assembly processes is really important. So where can you go and get an industrial supply of modified cells? Nowhere, as far as we can tell. But we can provide that and help you make the modifications you need. Control systems, feedback systems for manufacturing. Where is the right environment to develop that? Here's a tool set and expertise and a baseline process that you can leverage in developing that. And then other things, which may be not direct but indirect value, things like workforce training. We're working with a couple of our local community colleges, most notably San Jose City College, who's developing a photovoltaic manufacturing and panel fabrication curriculum. Right now, it's all classwork, but we can provide them with a lab facility to do some more hands-on training. Manufacturing training. When people come into SVTC, and I actually in my last company did this on the semiconductor side, people come in with a new innovation. They're really good at that particular technology, but they're not necessarily a photovoltaic manufacturing expert. Working with the SVTC team gives you the ability to learn how to become a manufacturing expert along the way so that when you leave, you're ready to do it on your own. Standards development. I think Bettina is going to be talking about standards. Having a physical facility where you can go and run tests and do things as part of those standards development is very valuable, as well as having access to a pool of people that are you can get input from. And then finally, innovative tools development. I guess maybe this is a little bit the same as this, but I would say there are sort of standard tools development, the companies that are just developing their next generation tool. And then there are tools development like what's going on through programs like DOE and ARPA-E, developing really revolutionary new tools, but with a need to integrate those into a process before you can actually get it into the market. So where are we now? We've had the facilities for a while. We had some things on hold for a while as well. But as I mentioned, we just announced that we'll be opening our doors with the Roth and Rao 30-megawatt line. The tools will be installed next quarter. We expect to have customers in place by the end of the year with full line operation on January 1st. Our facility is located in San Jose. Obviously close to a lot of solar innovation, but as SVTC Semiconductor is an indication of proximity is helpful but not mandatory. Companies work with us from all around the country. So because I heard this said many times today, our model is also not trying to select the winners. We want to provide an infrastructure in which all of the players can come in and get to the point where you can decide whether they're the winners. We're somewhat agnostic, maybe not completely because thin film and wafer-based are different, but within one class, we hope to be able to help everybody. And the benefits are faster startup, you don't have to build the fab, faster development, you can leverage the expertise of the center, and shorter time to market overall, no upfront capital expense, which in this debt-free market is important. Significantly reduced operating expense. Most companies only use 10 to 15% of their development line's capacity, but they have to pay for 100% of it. With us, you pay for the 10 to 15% you need, and we allocate the rest to somebody else. You still retain that hands-on development and IP security and independence. You get access to the CMOS facilities. We also have facilities for MEMS and some thin film tools. As well as experts in all areas of development, even those that you can't justify hiring for yourself, you can get access here. And we do everything up through pilot manufacturing. And our goal is really to allow companies to focus their resources, cash, and expertise on the things that they do best, which is their unique innovation. Let us provide the rest and get you to market quickly. So that's it.
Thank you, Steve. I always think of MIT as one of the greatest you know, universities at commercializing innovation, but when it comes to renewable energies, they have special challenges, right? Michael, oops, lost the name. Nolan Brown of MIT Fraunhofer Center for Sustainable Energy Systems will talk about a new program called the Fraunhofer System. Yeah.
Center for
Sustainable. Yes. Okay.
Thank you all very much. It's a great honor to be here today, and thank you for the opportunity to present a little bit about the industry-university partnerships and how they can come into play in the photovoltaics field. This is a little bit less of a presentation about Fraunhofer. I'm using it as an example for what we might want to look for in order to move this industry forward optimally. And some of the themes that we were hearing a lot this morning were questions around the lines of, you know, how do we help industry access universities so we can compete globally, we're more competitive that way? How do we train our workforce for the future in the PV? How do we enhance the university-industry-technology handoff? These are the questions that we think about all the time at Fraunhofer, the MIT Center, and certainly Fraunhofer, the larger body. Let me get into Fraunhofer itself, since not everyone's aware of what it is. It's a large applied, it started in Germany, but semi-government research facility. 15,000 employees, mostly scientists and engineers. They are all over different fields of applied research. And it is one of the world's largest nonprofit contract research organizations. Annual research budget of $2 billion. We're a lot more modest than the United States. 200 employees, 6 centers, and a $45 million operating budget. In the United States, we are a 501c3. We're an American company. Fraunhofer USA specifically, I mean, we go out of our way to state we're a U.S. company. And our newest venture is this MIT Fraunhofer Center for Sustainable Energy Systems. And what is the center? Well, it's an alliance between these two very large research institutions, one on the more basic side, MIT, and one on the very applied side, Fraunhofer. Within this this new laboratory, we have two things we're focusing on, solar PV modules and building efficiencies. We find that these are two of the areas that where we can make, as a nonprofit research center, huge, dramatic differences over a 5-year period. And I can get into that later or offline because I want to talk more about this. How to form these industry and university partnerships, because I think that's what actually leads to tremendous innovation. And Fraunhofer is one of the ways you can do it. Our group is supported by a prototyping unit, so we can come up with the modeling, the designs, and then we have a group that actually can build it. And we have an incubation unit. This is for startup companies, startup ideas that are, we can find them at MIT, we can find them within the DOE labs, rather the national labs, wherever. We can bring them into the incubation unit, help grow them to the point where a venture capitalist is ready to start funding. So now I want to get into the main body of why I'm here today, at least why Chuck asked me to come here today, the industry-university collaboration and what that means for PV. There's a need for it. There's a big one. There aren't very many applied PV research centers. And this has, in the past, with certain technologies, and in some cases PV, led to slow or premature commercialization. There isn't a smooth handoff, you can wind up in situations where there are unrealistic expectations in the market. If you think of things like compact fluorescent lighting, electric cars, things that are probably fundamentally good ideas, where there's fundamentally solid technologies behind them, get pushed into market too quickly, and it basically slows them down for a long period of time. It also leads to, this system leads to some misallocation of resources occasionally. You have places where you have commercial overinvestment before it's time to actually get into the technology. You're pushing into the for-profit world, and you're asking the company to make money before it's actually gotten the technology to a state where it has to get in order to be a stand-up technology. And this means that promising technologies can fall by the wayside. It means that we're funding fewer overall ideas. You don't get a nice spread pattern across different technologies you could look into. And it's just not, it's not, it tends to be not the most efficient capital allocation mechanism in the PV industry, in my opinion. When you look on the industry side of the house, we feel that photovoltaics R&D is at the university level is artificially limited. There are constraints. There's a lot of proprietary processes. There are national security issues with dual-use technologies. There are relevant equipment, as Steve was pointing out, has to be at hand in order to prove out ideas that are useful to industry. And this means that universities ultimately are nearly excluded from all but the more basic PV R&D. And if we really want to help industry leverage that talent base at our university level, leverage the investment we've made, a huge investment we've made in higher education in this country, we have to figure out how to bridge that gap. And we feel actually that unleashing it will yield major progress if we do it. So the big question then is, okay, so why isn't industry and university collaborating optimally? Where are the barriers? And I wanted to illustrate, based on some of our experiences to date, kind of looking at the industry, where in the PV market we see this happening most often. Problem one is confidentiality. And Steve was pointing out all these IP issues. Confidentiality is hard to maintain at the university. These are different. For-profits have very different mandates from universities. Universities are more open. It's hard to assign responsibility for disclosures. It's just generally, it makes an industrial player a little uncomfortable to put their IP into a university setting, open. There's the national security concerns like ITAR, which I mentioned. And there's just inherently difficulties using any kind of students on highly confidential projects. Second big problem is resource mismatch. It's an equipment one, which I illustrated already a little bit. But also, there is a university-sponsored research tends to be a bit inflexible. If you're an industry player and you are trying to figure out a solution, and you're with your industry partner, you have to get a scope of work that's about 5 years long. It has to be thesis size. So it can only start when the graduate student gets there, and when the graduate student graduates, project's over. So this is something that it just puts a lot more friction into the system. It's harder to proceed quickly, and it just makes it less attractive for industry to work with universities. And there's a mission mismatch. And all I have to say about that is, like, just think of publications. There's an extreme difference right there. MIT or any university would prefer to publish, and the industry would essentially prefer very often not to publish. And there's a couple other things. I won't get into the details, but there are a couple big points that we have to address in a solution. Now I want to address what could the potential solution be, and then how would this solution be applied in an American setting. So what is the model in Germany for this kind of collaborative R&D with universities? The challenges are obvious. You got a slow transition from the basic research labs to the applied research lines, to the industry research lines. And there's this overall challenge in working with the universities, and it's the valley of death, bridging the gap. You've heard it referred to by numerous speakers already. We want to bridge the gap by providing an applied research lab that has strong links to both sides of the fence and can accommodate both their needs. In Germany, this is the ecosystem. You've got your industry, and that's a private for-profit entity. You have universities and Max Planck, and that's a public entity. And then you have Fraunhofer, which is its source of income is 30% public. The reason it's 30% public is because we're supposed to be an aggressive applied research lab. We have to go out to the industry and ask them, what do you need? If industry is not willing to pay that extra 70%, we're going to start cutting our staff next year. So it forces us to be practical about what we're working for, and our clients are clear. It's serving industry. And of course, the y-axis, you can see kind of where our sweet spot is: applied research, development. And how does the model work? Roughly speaking, you'll have a university hooks up with an institute. In MIT's case, our scientific director has a faculty position as a professor at MIT. You have a professional team internal to Fraunhofer. It lets us do our, it provides continuity, and it lets us do in-house research that is not part of the university, so it can be confidential research. A large body of work, though, comes from students who are doing their thesis work for the university in our laboratories. And there's three sets of labs. You have confidential labs, you have shared labs, and you have open labs. Open labs in MIT, closed labs inside of the Fraunhofer Institute itself, and then a shared lab in between, which allows you to optimally use the resources at hand. That was the German model. And there are big differences. Well, there are challenging differences between the US models, or what happens in the United States and what the German model was set up to address. And my job over the last year has been to adapt the Fraunhofer model to the United States, specifically MIT. We have forged the MIT Fraunhofer Framework Agreement. We have there's the two president and the head of Fraunhofer, Bullinger. This addresses the three problems I just discussed. The resource mismatch. We basically identify how to we outline how to identify and share the R&D resources across both institutes. We have a joint R&D template for how to go out and win contracts. Who can we win them with? How do we turn this into a frictionless transaction for the industry players who want to work with our joint venture? It addresses the confidentiality concerns, like I was pointing out earlier. We have labs that can be extremely confidential, and we can and Fraunhofer controls the terms of how those labs will be run. And we have things that are less confidential, that are more open, that can be published. Obviously, the client would have to agree to all these things. But the key thing is it helps us determine how to segment a project into non-confidential and confidential components. And I don't want to get into the details of how to do that because it takes a little while to explain. I'm happy to talk about it offline. But if you look at any of the big technical projects you've worked on in the past, and you'll realize that at least it's a case-by-case basis, but a lot of times, a lot of the work you're doing is not super confidential stuff that you would never tell the world about. What you're keeping secret is that 25% that actually is the secret sauce. So how do you break up a project effectively and manage that so you can leverage university resources while keeping the other stuff secret? That's the mission. And then finally, addressing the mission mismatch. The university is having a different mission than industry. And we provide the flexibility necessary to provide for the educational mandate while getting industry what they need. This is a picture to show. This is designing the industry interface. I've pretty much addressed a lot of this already, so I'm going to skip to the next slide in the interest of time. I want to talk about the key challenges now. What are the key challenges, and how can a difference be made? Tuition structures are different between Germany and U.S. A German university sees allowing a student to work in the Fraunhofer lab, it's not a problem. It doesn't cost me anything to do that. In the United States, very often those universities see that student as a profit center. They're paying $50,000 a year to have that grad student in-house, and therefore they need a return. So that's a challenge. The second big challenge is just developing the normalcy of university and intermediary relationships. In Germany, Fraunhofer's been around for 60 years. It's not even a consideration. We work with all the big companies, and there's never any problems. This is a new model for the United States. It's going to take some success stories in order to just get it going. And one of the important things I noticed early when we started adapting was the Fraunhofer model was inherently set up to work with medium and large-sized companies. And that's because in Germany there aren't very many startups. In the United States, some great innovation is happening at the startup level, and especially in the Cambridge, MIT, Harvard area, you have tremendous great research projects to be worked on if you know how to interface with the smaller startup companies, and that's behind the incubator. So how did we address this? We addressed the tuition challenge by putting together a Fraunhofer MIT seed grant program. And we would jointly fund these grad students to work in our lab in the Fraunhofer laboratory on projects and earn their PhD there. How policymakers can help. If the intermediary models are of interest, and we buy into the fact that this is something that's good for America, how would a policymaker accelerate that? Well, industrial scholarships to pursue this kind of academic research will make a huge difference. So just awarding scholarships so that people can go to do their lab work in the applied changes the whole paradigm, really. Right now, there is a somewhat of a bias in higher education in the United States against applied research. This actually changes a lot of that. The governance structure. How do you develop a great university collaboration model? Well, you get a couple different guys in control to manage it. Tonio Bonacici, he's a professor at MIT. He and I kind of co-founded. I'm on the operations, the Fraunhofer USA side. Roland Schindler, he came actually from Fraunhofer ISE, it's one of the leading solar research centers in the world. And he's basically giving us the wisdom and experience of his work 26 years over there. And this gives everyone optimal input and sway into it, so you can adjust as it goes. And how can policymakers help here? Well, you can encourage more universities to engage with intermediaries. Just talking about it is something that's going to make things going to motivate universities to want to do something like that. And you can promote applied research capabilities as desirable for winning government grants or publishing papers or what have you, if this were something you wanted to do. And finally, the incubation center. How do we address the startup challenge? It was by saying, okay, we need to be able to find these really great technologies, be able to put them into an incubation center and make it work. We have to have a business model around an incubator. A lot of incubators fail because they don't know what business they're in. We know what business we're in. We're in the technical contract research for startup business model. It's a great place. Our partners can provide some other startup essentials like legal, financing, business mentoring, and HR, but we do the technical core research, and actually we can bring some funding to the table through a pot of angels who want to fund technology development in startups at MIT. And how can policymakers help here? Startup grants to overcome the CapEx costs of setting up one of these centers are big. And then there are a lot of grant programs targeted towards startup companies that we could work to make these more friendly to work with an incubator. And I can answer any questions on that offline. So in this, in summary, I'd say the direct interfaces between a university and industry can be challenging, but it's critical we do it. It's going to be very rewarding. There's confidentiality problems, there's research mismatch, and the myths and mismatches are the key problems you have to address. The intermediary institutions can unlock the university resources and really support industry. And if U.S. policymakers want to develop these university-industry interfaces through intermediating institutions, you can help address this tuition problem. You can encourage universities to pursue the partnerships with the intermediary institutions. And there can be more of an investment in these types of institutions' infrastructure, and because there's only when we have these centers in the United States, there's a limit to how much Germany will invest in a project like this. And just to give you an idea of what we had to do to found this one, we raised money from the state of Massachusetts, raised money from National Grid, and we got some money from Germany. But you know, in the future, to really grow these things out, there has to be a sizable investment coming from the United States, because this is really the market that is going to serve in the long run, because it's an American company. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Nolan. During the last conference that Chuck organized on photovoltaic manufacturing, there's a very spirited debate over whether the industry would benefit from a Sematech kind of consortium. And it was very heated at some point. But now we have the CEO of Sematech, Michael Polcari, who's going to talk about the potential applications of the Sematech model.
Thank you. I wasn't aware there was a heated discussion about this. So, what I'd like to do is give you an overview of what Sematech is, what it does, And I think in the spirit of what we do at Semitech, which is a member-driven organization, I think I can help you decide whether there's an application for our methodology, but I think you really need to decide if that's the right approach going forward. So as we saw this morning, reducing cost in manufacturing is a prime motive of what we're talking about today. And as was said as well, looking at this throughout the supply chain is critical in order to do this. And this is really what Semitech is about, reducing costs in the production of semiconductors, and that involves working throughout the supply chain at doing this. So if you look at our focus, it's really focused on decreasing cost per function, which is essentially another way of looking at Moore's law, which I think you're all familiar with. On the left-hand side is one way to address this. It's by increasing the number of transistors per area, primarily driven by driving the technology innovation. And in the past, it's really mostly come from shrinking dimensions with lithography. But more closely now, we need to work on new materials and new device structures and all of those types of things. I think one of the key points of what we do is really accelerating the commercialization of technology, and that's another aspect of what Semitech does. And if you look at the left-hand side, as I said, it's not necessarily for us to invent new devices or structures, but it's to put in place the infrastructure that allows the semiconductor industry to practice those things. So that could mean accelerating tool developments, accelerating materials developments, understanding if all the elements of a particular technology are ready, and making sure the ones that are lagging are being driven. And in the end, that accelerates the commercialization of that technology. The right-hand side is another way you reduce the cost per function, and that's really by attacking the productivity challenges. And for semiconductors, it's basically two ways. You can increase the area size, which happens about every 12 to 13 years, or the other way is to reduce the cost per wafer. And again, here I think there's a lot of analogies in terms of what we do in terms of helping to drive down costs. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in some detail later on. So first thing I thought I'd give you a little bit of background on how this came to be, and I think it's illustrative in terms of your discussions on how to go forward with something like this. So in 87, there essentially were two proposals that came out of the government, the government and industry, one from government, one from industry, and they sort of coalesced in terms of driving something like this. And it was really driven by a concern over losing market share to the Japanese in that time frame, and what could be done to address that. And so by working together, they came around to setting up this organization, Semitech, to go and address the problem. And I would say that at the beginning, there was not unanimity on what the problem was they had to address. But they all understood and agreed there was a problem. So I think for maybe about the first year, there was a lot of discussions over what exactly should the organization do and what was the problem they had to fix, other than that they all knew they needed to regain market share from the Japanese. So it was established as a joint government-industry partnership, and as you can see, 50% of the funding came from each of those entities to drive it forward. Let me talk about, about some of the success factors first, because I think this is important in terms of forming the organization. So one of them was there was commitment from top-level executives, both in the government as well as industry, to do this kind of thing. And without that, nothing would have happened. And that's essential to making this go. There was industry leadership in the organization to drive forward, and I think that's also important because industry can focus on the problems that they need to solve in terms of what's going to help them achieve the goals that they want to achieve. And there was a clear pre-competitive mission, and it really became working on the technology infrastructure in the United States to help regain that momentum. And that became the focal point, and that was what the emphasis was in the early days. And then towards the mid-90s, that began to shift in terms of maintaining the pace of the semiconductor roadmap towards reducing costs. And there was a broad representation of partnerships, both from the industry as well as the government, a lot of involvement from national labs, which has been ongoing. We've had a long relationship with NIST right from the very beginning through even present today. And, of course, the leveraging of the government funds. And another big success factor, which we've had even to date, is it's a member-driven organization. So our members set the research agenda, decide what the problems are to work on, and how to apportion the resources. And, again, it's really essential that the people whose problems you're trying to solve are the ones who decide on what you work on. I think that's a key factor of our success. So let me just go back to a few of the successes. And certainly we helped to achieve this parity and regain the market share from Japan at the time. And of course, the US industry has been healthy since then. It was certainly a big piece, and certainly with SRC and SEMI, we've helped maintain and establish the semiconductor roadmap, which is really our guideline. We've led a number of industry-wide initiatives, which are multi-billion-dollar efforts, and this is one of the areas that I think has been very successful for Semitech in terms of next wafer sizes or large, expensive patterning center systems, as well as looking at a lot of materials. And so we have looked at many different material systems for new innovations that are needed in semiconductors. And it allows the members to not only share the cost, but share the risk. And they can look at all of the different results and decide from that which are the few that they really want to pursue as they go forward. Certainly one thing not to be forgotten in the collaborative research is not everything is going to be successful. And so finding the dry holes and understanding those things aren't going to work in some senses is important, and doing it with a shared cost system. The Semitech effect, which is something we refer to in terms of job creation, I think the organization itself has tended to attract a lot of industry around it and created jobs in Austin, and I think you see the same effect in Albany around the College of Nanoscale Science and Engineering, where a similar type of environment is happening. And of course, our members see a lot of return on investment. They do a calculation that says they feel they get about a 5-to-1 return on what they invest in the organization. This is a chart of our organization, of who participates. And what I really want to focus on is the top half are all manufacturers, semiconductor manufacturers. And the real advantage to having a large number is that when you can set an agenda that is driven by a large single voice and driven by a consensus, and it helps to galvanize the response to that. And people know this is will result in something that the industry will utilize. The bottom half are suppliers, and that's been a modification in our model as we've been going forward. We now have equipment and material suppliers who become members of Semitech and help set and drive an agenda that they're interested in. We've always worked with suppliers from the beginning in terms of developing new tools on an aggressive schedule, but now we're looking to work with equipment material suppliers to help drive an agenda that helps them be more productive as they go forward. One of the advantages of this kind of an organization is to really coalesce a large network around single problems and drive to solutions, so we can pull together universities, government labs. As I said, we've had long programs with NIST. We have programs with LBNL where we use their resources as well as equipment and material suppliers to solve the problems that our members want to get solved to move forward. So I want to spend the rest of the time talking about a unique part of our program, which is really our manufacturing program, and it focuses on addressing manufacturing productivity. And that can be either strategically, where we look at what's the most productive architecture for a factory in the future, to very tactical kinds of cost reduction challenges, where we help our members reduce costs on some very tactical, near-term kinds of things that go on in a factory, and I'll explain, give you a few examples of that. And I think there's a lot of relevancy on things that can be drawn for the PV industry. And of course, sustainability is a common area, and I think it exists, something that the semiconductor industry can work with a number of industries on. Environmental problems are something we all face, and the materials and the gases and the conservation of consumables in the factory is a similar problem that we all need to work on. So this is a chart. On the left-hand side, again, are the things that we work on, and the right-hand side is how we do that. So we look at things like cost reduction, yield improvement, quality management, metrology, which is a big area that we focus on for our members, ESH, as I mentioned, and of course the factories of the future. The ways that we do work on these problems are a lot of benchmarking, where members share their data in a non-disclosed way, and also not only benchmarking of the data, but also best practices and ways that they go about being the best in class in some of those areas. We have what we call equipment productivity teams, where members will identify a common problem on a common tool or tool set, and they will work together with the supplier to fix those problems, and that becomes a much more efficient way than each one of them working on it independently. Of course, we run a number of workshops and things we call councils to address common kinds of problems that the members look at. For instance, spare parts. Everybody is interested in finding second sources for spare parts, and we can help them tabulate tables of data of where to go for those kinds of things. So very, very near-term tactical things to reduce costs. Of course, standards and roadmap development is something that we've talked about, and you'll hear as well from the next speakers. And then, of course, the material screening and characterization, which I mentioned already. So here's an example of benchmarking. We do blind benchmarking with our members. Now, as you can imagine, the metrics in their factories are very proprietary to them. And so we've developed 50 metrics that they share with each other on a non-disclosed basis, so you know who you are. You don't know who the others are. And then we allow the data to be collected. We work in what we call pay-to-play. You have to share data to get data back. And then in some of these, we'll actually look at best practices. In addition, members can ask for benchmarking on very mundane things, things like how much does the electricity cost in your particular factory? And you might think, well, what good does that do? Well, we had one member who, after looking at the power costs that people were paying in all the factories, went back to their power company and were able to get a reduction from their power company by telling them they weren't competitive with the rest of the world. So those kinds of things are what you can achieve when you have a number of people working together. And of course, the benchmarking is useful for everybody because you all have goals in terms of how much productivity you want to improve every year, but until you find out that your 10% improvement still leaves you off by 50 or 60%, you realize you have to do something different. And the fact that you are off by a large amount spurs you on to drive more things. So this is a very powerful technique and one of the things our members are very interested in. This is just an example of energy conservation taken to a very high level degree. You really can't see the chart very well, but the one on the lower right-hand corner is a tool that we've looked at. We found that most of the power consumed in the tool comes from the pumps on that tool, and one of the ways to conserve quite a bit of energy is to put those pumps in the idle mode when the tool isn't running process. And so we've been able to identify a certain number of those tools, those pumps, which you can idle and those which you can't idle. And so working on those things, the next step is go work with the equipment suppliers to work in these idle modes into their tools and equipment, and it then helps reduce the energy costs in the fab going forward. So this is a chart of a number of items that came out of a workshop July 12th in terms of issues that were felt needed to be worked on for the PV industry. I'm not going to go through all of these things, but I think if you look at this chart and you understand what Semitech does in the semiconductor space, you can see that these kinds of topics are also addressed by the kinds of things we do. So there's, I think, a lot of room for our methodology in terms of bringing some of that to bear on some of these problems as well. And lastly, I think the model does have a lot of application or experience not only in technology development, but manufacturing productivity and collaborative strategies are something that you can utilize in the PV industry. And certainly, our experience with organizing and recruiting consortia is something that we can bring to bear on helping formulate something that will bring a lot of cost reduction into the industry. So with that, I see I have 10 seconds left.
So. Thank you. Next up is Larry Sumney, the President and CEO of Semiconductor Research Corporation, a university industry research collaboration.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today and have the opportunity to address you on what we feel is a very important set of topics. I'm going to go through this very quickly, but the first part of my presentation is oriented towards acquainting you with what SRC is, how it got started, and what it has done, and then try to connect that set to what we feel we can do in this PV initiative that would be helpful to the country. SRC was started in 1982 as a result of a Hewlett-Packard study on reliability and yield of integrated circuits, and they came to the conclusion that U.S. integrated circuits were inferior to those coming from other places in the world. This was in 1982. And there were a number of reasons for that. Universities were not interested in research in silicon. Universities were not interested in research in manufacturing. They didn't consider that to be an academic pursuit. And so we were given the challenge of getting universities tightly coupled to the research needs of this industry, needs that were so expensively projected that no company felt that they could do it on their own. And so they wanted to pool together. Now, you have to remember that this industry was an extremely competitive industry at its beginning, and it's an extremely competitive industry today. Given that, they have agreed to collaborate on pre-competitive generic research that will help all of them. It was established for the reasons that I've mentioned, and it was meant to promote collaboration among researchers and departments in universities. Another thing that was characteristic of universities in 1982 is professors really weren't talking to each other. Departments were not talking to each other. Universities were not talking to each other. That culture has totally changed since SRC started. We have now university centers that work with other universities over a period of time and produce extremely good research results. And so we were left with the job of trying to generate a pool of experienced faculty and at the same time producing faculty and getting good research results to provide relevantly educated students that knew something about manufacturing, knew something about design. The basic operational guidelines of SRC are shown here. And in using these in various weightings, we've exercised this set of operational guidelines thousands of times over the past 27 years. To give you an example, industry is more tightly connected to nearer-term research. Universities are given more autonomy in operation in longer-term research. All of our research is done by research contracts. Milestones are defined, jointly worked out with the PI. Negative progress is fine. We just need to know that nothing's happening there. We have the choice of either changing directions or allowing them to continue a little bit longer. But this works out extremely well. And sometime in about the 1986 time frame, it became very clear, since SRC was an industry initiative, that we do an awful lot better if we really represented all three pillars of society: industry, universities, and government. And so we began to start looking to the government to leverage the investment in industry is putting into this in a significant way. And, of course, that has been really the major key to our ongoing success, is working with all three pillars and involving the government as well as universities and industry. Just to give you an example, we have all kinds of results. Obviously, I can only talk about one or two. I was going to talk about citations. It gets too long. So we decided to talk about this one. In 1981, because there were very little research effort in universities on silicon, 180 publications came out, and that compared to 304 from industry. In 2008, there were 2,226 publications that came out in silicon integrated research out of our universities that was supported by SRC. And you can see that this has a tremendous impact over time, because each one of these has a graduate student associated with it, and each one of those students has been hired for the most part by one of our members. So the valley of death, depending on how you define it, but if you define it as a good idea dying because no one picks it up, we bridge that valley of death by getting the students into industry where they continue to work on the thing that they did their dissertation on. In terms of numbers, since our inception, we've invested over $1.3 billion from our members as well as government participation, 3,000 research contracts. We've supported over 7,000 graduate students. We've worked with 1,700 faculty, 241 universities, and we've delivered 43,000 some odd technical documents, 326 patents, software tools, and we've worked with 2,315 research tasks or themes. And that's really where things come from, looking at things at the task level, integrated sometimes into a center, sometimes working singly with a professor and several graduate students. We were recently the recipient of the National Medal of Technology, which was awarded to SRC for building the world's largest and most successful university research force to support the rapid growth and 10,000-fold advances of the semiconductor industry, and also for providing the concept of collaborative research as the first high-tech research consortium, and for creating the concept and methodology that evolved into the International Technology Roadmap for Semiconductors. So what are the secrets of the success that we've had? Competitors have agreed to collaborate. That's key. It didn't happen instantaneously. In the first technical meetings that we held at SRC in 1982 and even early 1983, you couldn't get anybody to say anything because they were afraid they were going to divulge a secret. They had to learn how to collaborate. The CEOs had made the decision they were going to do it. Took a while to trickle down to the technical people, but eventually, this is one of our strongest things right now, the collaboration that occurs at technical meetings amongst our members involving universities. We just recently had a summer study where we had university representation. We had all of our technical people there, and the output from that fed into our board meeting where, again, the University Advisory Council was there, and that gives us our strategic ideas for the next 5 years coming from our members. So we are a member-driven organization, just as Mike says, but we also have strong government participation in all these meetings, particularly from the government agencies that are providing support to us. We're pre-competitive, and we share the IP. It's like we work with research contracts, and universities own the intellectual property, but they provide our members with royalty-free, non-exclusive access. We make sure there's no blocking IP. So if we come up with a big result, somebody holds an exclusive in the background, we can't use it. So we look at everything at the beginning, make sure there's no blocking IP, and that's what we do in the area of intellectual property. It took universities a while to get used to this. I would say in about 1997, 1998, we developed a Blue Ribbon panel. They came up with language on background intellectual property, working with presidents of universities, and up to this point, we've had very little difficulty working with universities. We have world-class researchers. Everything is done competitively. We solicit white papers, maybe get 100 to 150 responses, work through those, pick the best 10, solicit proposals, work through and evaluate those with industry, and pick maybe one or two that we're going to support. So everything is world-class that we do. And because of the way the industry has changed, it's very, very quick-changing industry. All of the companies were integrated device manufacturers at the beginning. We started to have people break off and start to do just the design These are called the fabless companies, and then you have foundries that evolved to do the manufacturing. We have had everybody as members from the beginning, not only the integrated device manufacturers, but the fabless, the foundries, the equipment manufacturers, and the software providers are all represented in our membership base. We are accountable. Every year, we're measured by our companies, and we're also measured every 2 years by our universities. Universities are, we are funder of choice. We have risen from second or third to first from many of the universities, and our member companies repeatedly rate us on a 1 to 5 scale as about 4.5 in what we provide to them in terms of value. Now, for other industries, an observation such as Moore's Law, if we start talking about roadmaps, may not be apparent or possible. But the way SRC started this process was to first look for the research needs, get industry agreement on what do we do in research now. What are your major needs in devices? What are your major needs in processing? What are your major needs in interconnect? What are your major needs in packaging, design, that kind of thing? And we start working towards those. What Moore's Law has done is it's put a cadence on it. You try to get from one node to the next node, and the node is defined as a minimum feature size. And that has served to excite the industry to beat the roadmap. And so actually, this industry is ahead of the roadmap. But it wouldn't have happened without that cadence-driven thing that Moore's Law provides. So this is the way we began the ITRS journey with research needs, and we feel that for PVs, research needs could also be used as we develop, working with DOE, a roadmap for PVs, for instance. This is the way SRC has evolved. We have a number of separate programs. The members are listed below each one. The first one ensures the vitality of the current industry. It's shorter-term research. The next one works for research through about 2018, where it's looking to break down all the barriers to extend CMOS as far as it theoretically can go. The next one is looking for what happens beyond CMOS, what is going to be the next switch. It may be charge-based, it may be spin, it may be something else. The next one is an education alliance, and I'm not going to talk about any of these, but this is where we fund fellowships and scholarships and undergraduate programs. And the next one is topical research collaborations, which is something that we've just started about a year ago. One of these is the Energy Research Corporation, and this is where we have actually started a program in PVs. And it's going to start with a modeling and simulation effort at Purdue University to model and simulate different structures for PVs and assess their viability. As a matter of fact, the first signed membership agreement that we got today at this meeting from one of the companies in the room. We expect two or three others within the next week. And then we will be getting leverage from Purdue University, and we're looking for leverage from perhaps the state of Indiana, and certainly we would like to see leverage from the Department of Energy. We have another one called National Institute for Nanoelectronic Engineering, and members are shown there. This is working with Acreda, with Sandia, and also with DOE. You remember I talked about weighting these things differently. This talks about the time frame for research, the technology that we're doing in each of these four programs. Topical collaborations are variable. We can pick anything from PVs to bioelectronics to perhaps biomed, anything that is in the adjacent application space of semiconductor technology. Industry participation varies. You can see on the really long-range research, such as number 3, industry is involved in the sense that there is a review of the program every year. Government participation would be very strong in topical research collaboration because we think that working with various government agencies, they would be very interested in this approach, which has been shown to be highly successful. So that's what I want to talk to you about, applying the collaborative model that we've developed to new technical areas such as we've started in the TRC concept, to leverage our successful R&D road mapping and industry engagement model, and to supply opportunities for new product directions for our current members. I mentioned 9. It's looking at nanomaterials and nanoengineering. TERC, which is the Energy Research Corporation, is going to focus first on the modeling and simulation of PVs at the NSF-NCN capability at Purdue University. And the companies that are interested in that at this point are shown below. One of the reasons why we're working on these kinds of things is they bring new members into the SRC that we normally wouldn't get. For instance, ExxonMobil would not normally join SRC semiconductor program as it exists, but they are interested in PVs. Corning is interested in PVs. Lockheed Martin is interested. Goodyear is interested. And also some of our members are interested, such as IBM and Intel. And so this brings a set of companies together to collaborate that are different than the typical sets that we've had before. And we're hoping what comes out of that is a lot of new innovation, new methodologies for collaboration, and really good results from the universities. People have mentioned this. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. There's a lot of commonality between PV manufacturing research and semiconductor research. Common materials for the most part. In many cases, common equipment, common processes, many technology overlaps, and they both focus on increasing efficiency and reducing costs. These are all things that we've done for the semiconductor industry. This is adjacent to the semiconductor industry. It's an application space, and we feel that this same model can prove to be very good in this area. So we would like to bring together industry, universities, and government, for example, the DOE laboratories, NIST, and so forth, to develop roadmap and technology assessments to identify gaps and common challenges, to focus on pre-competitive research and the underlying technology that needs to be developed for manufacturing improvement, and to make the research results broadly available to all of our participants. How do we do that? We have a very evolved, high-quality website. As soon as a research result is completed and made available from the universities to us, way before publication, we make it immediately available to the interested people in our membership base. They can use that any way they want because it's not restricted, and that makes the members have a significant advantage over what most people get out of university research when they have to wait for refereed publications to publish it. So this is one of the things. The other thing is the student. We build relationships between our member companies and the students. We do it through a mentor program where companies talk to students, work with students at the university. We hold technical meetings where students deliver papers, research papers, and they've gotten so much better in the last few years, it's incredible. And then we have a session where the companies sit down and talk to these students, and they hire them. And so that's how that research transitions into the company almost immediately after graduation. By coordinating research in this area, we can minimize overlap, we can leverage efforts that the government may be working on, industry may be working on, even universities may be working on. Leverage those and collaborate, and you will see that the efficiency of the dollars spent greatly increases. A center could be in a university, or it could be in a federal laboratory. As I said, we have one now in a CRADA arrangement with Sandia. We've had others. We had one at Los Alamos earlier, maybe 10 years ago. That works very well. We could also do it in a university. We have many examples of university centers that are very funded at very high levels. And I've got to say that probably the most successful example of really high government funding is in that second program I showed you, CMOS to its limit, where DARPA matches us one for one and has since 1998 in that program. And so we do this through the OTA arrangement with DARPA, which is the Other Transactions Authority, which we think eARPA could make available under DOE. And so that would be one thing that would be useful to look at, such that we could engage rapidly and quickly with DOE to start on these programs. We're not a demonstration or prototype facility. We do not spend money on bricks and mortar. But we can interact with demonstration facilities, should there be them, and we can also work with other proprietary projects. In summary, I think collaborative research will be much more efficient than people proceeding on their own, and it will spur innovation because you bring these people together and wonderful things happen. You need industry to commit and lead by jointly identifying areas of R&D needs where non-exclusivity is acceptable at the pre-competitive level. and government can incentivize by providing significant co-funding for implementation of research plans. It doesn't have to be on a one-for-one basis. We have a recent program with NSF which is matched 3.4-1. We have an interconnect program with CASED in New York which is matched, I think, 1.9-1. We even have a program where we're getting matching leverage from the city of South Bend, Indiana, of $1 million over 3 years. This is from a fairly small city, yet they consider this important enough that the city has made available to leverage this research at Notre Dame. Given the diversity of technologies, it's distributed but very, very coordinated. Universities and federal laboratories seem preferable to building a pilot facility to us. DOE Energy Frontier Research Centers are a very good start, but in looking at them, we can't really see a strong connection to industry. And so that collaboration that occurs between industry and government is most likely not going to happen very well. DOE could use the flexibility offered by ARPA-E, such as using OTA agreements, to coordinate a position of the PV manufacturing process in an SRC-like consortium such as the TURC that we've started, and it's guided and funded by industry with doing research either in national labs or universities or both. So in summary, we see something like this. If you want to have a chart, all of the things that I've mentioned sort of relate, and there's information and things flowing each way between this industry, academic, and government consortium, which we feel we could play a major role in, ARPA-E, innovation hubs, DOE laboratories, academia, PV manufacturing industry, perhaps a pilot facility, and energy frontier research centers. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This morning there was some discussion of whether the photovoltaic industry is mature enough or not mature enough to collaborate on standards. Now we have Bettina Weiss, who has led and helped lead the standards initiative for SEMI for years. And now she is leading SEMI's photovoltaic group.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for staying with us all this exciting day. I'm getting a lot of stimulation and good thinking and new ideas from you all today. So I thank you, first of all, for that. I thank the National Academies and the DOE for inviting me today. It's really exciting to be here. So I would like to set the stage just a little bit, a few words, if I may, about SEMI and our PV group, just to give you a feel for who we are. And then dive straight into industry standards. And I may not even be able to answer satisfactorily the question of whether or not we're ready for standards, but I want to show you what's been done and the efforts that are currently underway. So without further ado, SEMI, we are a almost 40-year-old industry association. We're global. We have about 2,000 member companies. Primarily, as you can tell by the acronym SEMI in the semiconductor manufacturing sector. But over the years, we've expanded into flat panel display, into microelectromechanical systems, a little bit of nano. And for the past 2 years, about 2 years, very, very seriously and very intensely in photovoltaics. So the PV group is a new SEMI initiative. It captures those SEMI members, about 30% of them now out of 2,000, that are active in PV. Some are just investigating if they have feasible product that they could use in PV manufacturing. Others have turnkey solutions out the door. So you have the whole gamut of readiness and industry participation. But as you can see, there are unique challenges that we have to collectively address, I believe. PV is very policy-driven, especially here in the U.S., as well as a few other countries around the world. The industry structure is still not particularly well-defined. You have from very, very small to very, very large companies operating in different technologies in different markets, focusing on different manufacturing targets. So I think it's going to be a while until all this shakes out, and maybe as an association we can lend somewhat of a calming voice to the fray. We experience deployment bottlenecks. We also experience very, very high logistics costs, for example, transportation costs of modules and panels. So all these are issues, and there are many more, that we feel that we can best address and tackle and resolve speedily if the industry stakeholders come together and work with one another for a best possible solution. So PV is a semiconductor-based technology that will, I think, hugely benefit from the chip industry experience. And we've heard this in several talks already today. I told you that the PV segment has grown significantly within semi, and it is largely due to the fact that a lot of semiconductor and flat panel display equipment and material suppliers have transferred and crossed over into the PV space. So we are supporting those members very, very actively in PV, but we also see an influx of pure players in the solar PV and solar industry. So the combination of those two has been really interesting and has generated a lot of new thoughts, a lot of ideas of what has to be done in standards and public policy and in other areas that that we service and support. And all of this, of course, with the end goal of accelerating commercialization, of reducing manufacturing cost, and accelerating the path really to mass deployment of solar energy to the greater population. I can skip that. So what I want to focus on today is really industry standards that can arguably hinder or help innovation and speed things up. I want to talk about a little bit of good and solid industry and market information that is critical as you plan for your next fiscal year and prepare your business plan. Again, an area where we semi very intensively collaborate with other research firms and market statistics companies. But overall, it is about effective buyer and seller collaboration and finding those commonalities in those areas where, again, we can do more together faster and better. We are governed, if you will, certainly by our International Board of Directors, but really on a strategic level also by advisory committees. I just wanted to point this out. They consist of semi-member companies and non-members, but they engage the entire supply chain, our section of it that we service, predominantly feedstock to cell module. So we have equipment and material suppliers participating, obviously our core constituents, but we also have cell and module manufacturers involved and engaged and active in just about all of our core competencies that we support. So this has been a good ride. This has been very helpful and critically important to us as we build our PV platform to better support the industry. I think it was mentioned, I think surprisingly rarely to me a little bit, the fact that the PV industry is global. And I think we have to keep that in mind. This is the context that we work in and live in if we're active in photovoltaics, that our interests here in the United States have to be aligned, sometimes even adjusted, based on global trade conditions and developments. That makes us, or that makes the necessity for national collaboration obviously very, very critical, but also for global partnerships. And I get to that in a minute. But of course, really, it is about creating stronger demand on the U.S., and with that will come a strengthened, a bolstered U.S. Manufacturing supply chain, as well as more jobs that we very desperately need. So we think that the collaboration between and among industry and government will certainly positively impact global partnerships as well as national ones. But available funding right now, we think, really needs to be directed to U.S. manufacturing platforms and strengthening those, strengthening organizations such as SRC and SEMI and PV Group and quite a few others who are trying, because they're member-driven, to accelerate their members' access to information, access to research, and develop a faster path to a commercialization. So I think it's all really about increasing competitiveness as well as just getting ready for the global marketplace. I've seen that. So actually, Mike mentioned it. We had PV Group and the DOE had a joint workshop on July 12th on the onset of Intersolar North America and Semicon West in San Francisco. It was an exploratory workshop. We said, you know, is there an appetite, is there readiness in the U.S. to develop an either domestic, a national, or even an international technology roadmap for PV that would be maybe akin to the ITRS, the International Technology Roadmap for Semiconductors. Is that a good model? We had 150 people show up. We had about 90 people on the wait list. So there was certainly interest in finding out more about what this could possibly be. We had good participation from all sectors of the supply chain. We were a little light on cell and module makers, so we definitely have to go back and get their feedback on this idea. The first part of the workshop started out with providing perspectives from the semiconductor industry as well as other regions on ITRS and other PV roadmap efforts that are happening, for example, in Japan and in Europe. So we had representatives talk to us about that just to set the stage for what happened next, which were breakout sessions. We broke off into four separate groups, and those groups were tasked with answering really three fundamental questions. What are the top 10 challenges in your specific area, be it materials and substrates or EH&S or facilities or what the case may be? Well, the top 10 challenges, which ones would benefit from a collaborative approach? And would a roadmap be the right mechanism and tool to do that? And I think very resoundingly the answer was pretty much yes, we need a roadmap or some such thing that we can collaboratively work on. When we asked for a show of hands of who would like to contribute and be part of a longer term effort, just about everybody raised their hand. So there's something, there's some appetite and some interest certainly there to do that. Again, we need to validate this with the cell and module community. But I'm hopeful that it will at least lead to more conversations, to more dialogue and interactions between the stakeholders. Again, I covered this. So the next steps really are we need to figure out how to frame this monster, which potentially it could be. How do we want to structure an effort like this? I would really like to talk to Sematech. I would like to talk to SRC and see is there a way of getting together and doing it as a joint project, for example. We need to figure out how to fund it. It's one thing to say, yes, maybe we have the mechanism and the platforms and the contacts in place to move forward with this, and maybe we can engage everyone. But we need a little bit of help to have it funded, be it through industry, be it through our membership, for example, or maybe also with help from the DOE. So one idea is to form a steering council to help us manage the thing and get a project plan in place with a timeline that says, okay, here's one way of executing this thing. So stay tuned. If you're interested, I'd be happy to take your business cards afterwards and I keep you in the loop. Moving on from roadmap into standards, we know from the ITRS experience that many, probably hundreds of standards and safety guidelines have been derived based on and because of the ITRS and the information that it provided. We're talking about interfaces, tool-to-tool communication, improved process efficiency, a big cost down, by the way, reduced materials volume, very, very important in PV, I think, reduced risk to operator tool and the environment. We haven't talked about EH&S a lot, and I have one slide towards the end that I would like to share with you. But those are the things that came out of the ITRS among hundreds of others, and they found their way into the semi-international standards program and have really helped the industry collectively save quite a bit of money. Just a short history of SEMI standards. SEMI itself was established in 1970, and I see that there's a couple of zeros missing. I don't know what happened there. We are AD, not BC. So in 1970, we were formed. The standards program was established just 3 years later, 1973, primarily to address the issue of the wafer specifications used in the semiconductor industry. We had back then about 2,000 different wafer specs, all asking for different sizes and different parameters and specifications. And finally, the industry got together and said, we have so much waste. There was actually a silicon shortage at the time. So let's get together and figure out one size wafers. So that's kind of what propelled us into the standards business. You can tell that over the years and over the decades, we've moved, as our members have moved, into other disciplines such as flat panel display, MEMS, and now, again, very, very seriously, PV. Interesting, and regardless how you argue the standards question, ready whether yes or no, standards was the first initiative that our members wanted kick-started right away. The committees were formed just a couple of years ago, a year and a half sometimes, two of them this year in Japan and Taiwan. But we have 400 people globally working on this stuff. So there's got to be something, and maybe it's just a matter of jumping in early and seeing what's happening, or stopping what's happening, as the case may be, or influencing and guiding. But there certainly is a lot of interest in standards. As I said, you know, Europe was first, not surprisingly. They formed their committee in early 2007, followed by North America a little later that year. And again, this year, Taiwan and Japan came to the table, so we now have a truly global effort going forward. And the committees, anybody with an interest in participating can do so. It's free of charge, it's open, very transparent. We work very much with academia in the various regions where we're active. Governments, if they play a significant role, but certainly R&D and industry. We also are thinking about a standards PV roadmap, specifically focused on standards. So whatever happens to the PV technology roadmap will certainly impact what happens to standards one way or another. And the basic message of the first phase of the roadmap was, let's leverage what we have. Semi-published almost 800 documents, test method specifications for equipment and materials, safety, everything. We assessed on a higher level, not per document, but per category. We assessed what we had, and our committee said about 64 out of 80 major categories are applicable. That means the PV industry has already documentation it can use and benefit from and save money with by applying and implementing those standards that are out in the field and have a proven track record in semiconductors and elsewhere. So the just one quick word on priorities and gaps that were identified at the same time. Automation seems to be a major issue. So we're targeting that with a sense of urgency. EH&S, as I mentioned, facilities is a big deal. You talk about, for example, a brownfield fab. Say you have an old 200 millimeter wafer fab and you want to refurbish it and make it into a PV fab. The facilities issues, I think, are daunting if you don't have any proven best practices and standards in place. Plus, the cost should be probably astronomical. So there's still a lot of new and PV-specific and PV-unique issues that we need to figure out and work on. I'm going to skip over that. Meeting the EHS challenge. Again, I would like this to be a topic for broader discussion. I don't see it brought up very much in most of the conferences, but I think we're dealing with really nasty substances and a lot of them too in the manufacturing line. So I think it is a premier area for collaboration to get together and figure out ways to reduce the volume, make the process safer. Have a good emergency response system, but also expand it to a larger sustainability message and saying, you know, what is the end of life cycle here, and how can we recycle material? How can maybe the manufacturer take its system back after a certain period of time, and how can we ensure that nothing ends up in the ground or in the air? So with that, I leave you with the message that I think the learning curve that we're all on, it's a very steep one, and I think it can be accelerated by collaboration. We certainly invite all of you, organizations, industry, government, research community, to talk to us. We're willing to help. We have national as well as international arms that we can utilize and contacts that we can utilize. And with that, I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Let's see. I think we have some time for questions, right, John?
Dan Josel from NIST. It's interesting to me to hear the remarks that Semitech might play some sort of organization along those lines. And my question simply is that when I look back at Semitech and I see the impact it's had in interconnect and other types of technologies, we were starting with a technology which was premier top of the line, CPU, high profit margins, even though there were needs to move along to advance. Here you're starting with something that's basically a commodity. Energy is already provided by half a dozen different dominant technologies, none of which is solar, of course. So my question for either Mike or Larry would be, are there differences here in trying to get together industries who are basically trying to fight on margins, as we hear from First Solar and others, where yes, there will be many others he expects who will be along these same price lines shortly enough. Are there differences that one might anticipate in working in a commodities area, look at the semiconductor industry with NAND and the absence of profits for years.
So a short answer to that is we have memory suppliers who collaborate today. Toshiba, Samsung are both working in our organization. So I haven't thought about that particular aspect of it, but the question is there room to collaborate on things early on that can save dollars for the people who are doing the manufacturing? And if there are areas that they all need to work on, there's no point in each one of them doing it individually if there's no competitive edge from it. So I think that's what has to be explored. And it seems like there's always areas like that.
More for silicon on steel, cadmium telluride on glass.
Well, okay, so my guess is they all have vacuum systems somewhere. And so there's no pumps in the factory anywhere. Air handling is a common entity. And one of the things we do is work on how to modify the air handling to make it best. I mean, those may not be the best examples, but I think that's something that comes out of maybe the road mapping kind of thing. Are there common attributes that can be addressed that will save money or not?
Yeah, I would like to expand and agree with him. If you look at Micron, for instance, commodity memory manufacturer, they've been involved in our number two program, the Focus Center program, for the last 12 years and have maintained strong industry participation levels and seem to be getting a lot out of it, looking toward the future. We're holding a memory workshop coming up in October. They were one of the first companies to sign up to attend that memory workshop. So I see that even the commodity manufacturers get enough out of this that they're very, very interested.
I'd like to add something to that. So there's another difference between semi and PV, which is that the equipment and facilities requirements are substantially lower for a Semitech-like PV facility than they were for Semitech. And so you're right, it's more of a commodity industry, but it's also a much smaller investment required to make it happen. I think actually, this is a somewhat biased opinion, but I think we've met with more than 100 PV companies. One of the biggest things is capital efficiency in those early days as being one of the drivers, one of the big problems of the industry because of the investment community's reluctance to invest in very capital-intensive early-day work when there's still risk that the technology will be manufacturable or something. And so even though those dollars may not be large from a Semitech-like size, they're large for individual companies, and that's a real barrier that I think some sort of a shared facility can help with. And then the last thing is the examples you gave when you were pointing out that it's difficult to have any kind of standardization were all thin film examples. And I think it is important to sort of recognize that the industry does split into these two categories of thin film and wafer, and both of them have a lot of innovation. Both of them have a lot of companies. Thin film is a lot harder to start to get your arms around in terms of how you come up with something that has a high leverage value across the industry. Wafer, as we gave an example, is fairly easy. I think with thin film, that's going to change over time too, because the fact is now that capital's not available to allow people to go off and build billion-dollar custom fabs for technologies that have never been in manufacturing before, I think people are going to sort of be forced to start standardizing, and I think work like what Bettina's doing and Semi is going to help with that.
Well, it seems like another issue is that Mr. Eaglesham this morning was saying that First Solar and the industry in general is moving down the cost curve pretty impressively as it is, but I guess the question is, could this be accelerated through a consortium or collaboration?
I mean,
well, to follow up on that, I think one of the key points about the Semi and Semitech and SRC presentations is that there's no conscription. It's a voluntary participation and voluntary contributions, so that if they're willing to do that, as it seems there's, as we just heard from Bettina, there's willingness to do that, then there's a, clearly a common good. I think we have to be careful about talking about commodity industries. Economists recognize commodity industries, but they don't recognize commodity economics. And I think it's important to recognize that we are able in this country to compete across a wide variety. You know, some people talk about commodities in the oil industry, but as Iraq and Mexico demonstrate, if you're not using the latest technologies, you actually aren't able to maintain your production. And Micron is a very good example of a so-called commodity industry where their design and production enables them to compete globally right out of that high-tech center in Idaho, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's important that we break past some of these myths. So the self-selection and the cost share, which has been described in each of these three that I mentioned, strikes me as answering this question about whether or not, you know, if they don't come, then there's no cooperation. On the other hand, the catalytic impact of federal funding, even when it's small, is absolutely crucial in bringing them together. And the strong history you have here, I think, is also, I'd like to ask the group, you know, if we don't do this, it's the compared to what question? You know, I'm not arguing with you. I'm trying to dialogue a little bit about, I'm not addressing you personally. It's just, if we don't do this, if we don't use these institutions, then what do we do? And I'd like to suggest to the group as a whole that when the president was talking about shovel-ready projects, he didn't mean you were supposed to go invent another shovel. So we, I think, should perhaps use the shovels we have. If there are no, having interrupted the dialogue there, if there are no more questions, perhaps we could have a round of applause for a really successful